Well, we will call the meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. It's good to see and hear people in person and electronically via technology. I think is Mark on?
Yes, I'm here. I'll be glad to call the roll, Dr. Tudor.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Mr. Rob Binky. Dr. Lisa Bellner.
Present.
Dr. John Benitez.
Here.
Dr. John Brophy.
Yo.
Dr. Richard Cole.
I'm here.
Dr. Ceresia Cummings.
Here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman.
I'm here.
Dr. Jeff Hazelwood.
Here.
Mr. Dan Hedrick.
Here.
Ms. Jenny Howard.
Here.
Dr. Greg Kaiser. Ms. Amy Moses. Dr. Wills Oglesby.
Here.
Dr. Robert Snyder.
Here.
Ms. V. Story.
I'm here.
Dr. Jim Talmadge.
Here.
Dr. David Tudor.
Here.
Ms. Misty Williams. And Kyle Jones sent a message. Amy Moses is in attendance, I believe, but was not able to respond. So we do have a quorum that is more than enough for a quorum. So, Dr. Tudor, you're free to proceed.
Misty Williams is here. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Wow. That's insane. That's really good attendance. Very good. So hopefully everyone's had a chance to review the minutes from the December 13, 2022 meeting. Any comments, dissensions, recommendations regarding those minutes? Or corrections? If not, we'll take a motion to accept.
So moved, Rick Cole.
Thanks, sir. Do we have a second?
Second.
Very good. Thank you. Any opposed? No? So we will approve the December meeting minutes as written. Conflict of interest forms is still on our agenda, so hopefully that one last form has found its way to Susie's office.
Yes, sir, it has. We're good. Thank you all.
All right. So those follow the state fiscal year, correct? So,
correct.
Okay. So it will be forthcoming soon. Very good. All right, so we'll move ahead into old business, ODG update from March.
We did not receive any new updates from ODG.
Good. All right, so wasn't just my good, okay. Medical fee schedule update.
So, the three new medical fee schedules are being analyzed by the Attorney General's office. They gave us an update approximately 2 weeks ago, and they had reassigned the fee schedules to another attorney due to workload issues. We have not heard an update since that time, but we will wait. Once the fee schedules have been approved, then we will have an update as to when they would become effective. As far as Medicare is concerned, as of the first of the year, Medicare reduced the conversion factor from $35 to $34.06. It seems that every time we make an adjustment in the medical fee schedule to try to encourage some specialists to come into the workers' compensation system, we end up with Medicare reducing the conversion factor, and we end up in the same position that we were. We try to address this in the fee schedule because it does affect access to care. The idea of workers' compensation is to get the best treatment from the best providers to the patients at the proper time. And we have to do everything we can from a reimbursement mechanism to try to establish access to care for the very difficult subspecialists. That's all the update I have, unless somebody has any questions or further information.
Is that something we see happening this year, you think?
It's happened for the last 3 years in a row that the reductions have been, the ones they announced in November have been more draconian than what ultimately happens. Most of the time, the Congress will finally pass a fix to it sometime in March or April, retroactive to the first of the year. This year, they actually did it with the Budget Reconciliation Act that passed at the end of December. And so the final figure for Medicare then came out actually before the first of the year, and mostly, which is earlier than what it usually happens.
So that is the final figure?
So far, yes, that's the final figure for this year.
What about our... What about the Tennessee fee schedule? When should we see the adjustments? Well, I mean, we're increasing percentage, right? Or we're addressing it with the fee schedule?
Well, the changes to the fee schedule include an increase in the percentages of the Tennessee-specific percentages for occupational medicine and physical medicine. Both of those were instituted with the last fee schedule changes last year, and those were moved up to 180%. That would be effective as of this January. But the conversion factor was the problem. So the conversion factor dropped 3%. You got about a 15% increase for occupational medicine and physical medicine. But it ended up being much less because of the drop in the conversion factor.
Physical medicine includes the I-7 code?
No.
There it goes.
No, it was PM&R and only for E&M codes.
Yeah. Any other comments on or questions on medical fee schedule? If not, we'll move on to legislation update. Is Amanda with us today?
No, but Troy's going to give it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but Amanda is very busy right now. She's down at the legislature Tuesday afternoons. Well, Tuesdays are pretty busy committee days this time of year, but the Senate Commerce and Labor meeting is always at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays. So the House Banking and Consumer Subcommittee meeting is Tuesday afternoons as well. So that's the subcommittee in the House that hears our work comp bills. But so far, it's been a pretty busy legislative session. We have an administration bill, which is House Bill 82 by Lamberth, Senate Bill 263 by Johnson, and it does several things procedurally, but the main things, focus points that we wanted to try to hit in that administration bill are a death benefit from the uninsured employer fund. Currently, as many of you know, we have a benefit of $20,000 in temp benefits and $20,000 in medical maximum for an injured worker who gets hurt at work while working for an uninsured employer. An employer broke the law, didn't carry work comp coverage. There's no benefit available in the traditional sense. So we have a limited benefit available. And up until now, we didn't have a death benefit. We had a claim a couple of years ago where there was an injured worker who died and left some dependents, but we were not able to pay anything because we didn't have the statutory authority to do that. So the bill, which has moved through the Senate, and it is moving through the House as amended, and hopefully maybe in another week it will be finished through the process, but that will provide a $20,000 death benefit from the uninsured employer fund. It'll also give us rulemaking authority for the certified physician program, which is a very high priority item for our bureau and for the administration. Some other housekeeping things that it'll do, but those are the two main things that that we're focused on. Firefighter PTSD presumption, that bill has sort of come back year after year after year. It can never seem to get through the fiscal process because of the fiscal impact to local governments. This year, they're trying something different with this state grant program that would be administered by the Department of Labor, Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Whether that clears the fiscal process remains to be seen, but it's a popular piece of legislation. All 33 senators signed on, and I think most all of the members of the House signed on and sponsored as well, but there's a fiscal impact, and that'll have to clear the budget process. And that is Senate Bill 856 by Senator Bailey. There is a bill that was filed that is not moving forward, at least as of now, Senate Bill 1263 by Ackberry. That would change the law. Tennessee, as most of you know, you get injured at work, your employer, insurance carrier, work comp carriers do provide a panel of three or more physicians. There are some states that just let you go to whatever doctor you want to go to and seek treatment and it's paid for. That is the gist of the bill that was filed by Senator Ackberry. There's not a significant fiscal difference in panel states versus non-panel states, but there would be an impact in Tennessee on our utilization review numbers, the MIRR program numbers, more IMEs. So there would definitely be a significant impact. But from what I'm hearing, there's not enough support to get that bill through the committee process, but we are monitoring that.
Troy, can you give me one more time the Senate bill and House bill number, please?
Senate Bill 1263. House Bill 1467. So Representative Towns has it in the House. And again, that has not made it to a committee calendar yet, but we'll keep monitoring that. Senate Bill 97 by Wally. That's a bill that Amanda and I have had some limited involvement. Senator Wally had two widows from a plant down.
Could I stop you for just a second?
Sure.
Dr. Kaiser had his hand raised. Dr. Kaiser, you have a question?
Sorry, I just got here. I've been having trouble getting logged in, and Susie told me to let you know I'm here. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm here. Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, welcome, Dr. Kaiser.
For some reason, the video is not working. So,
Senate Bill 97 by Wally, Senator Wally from West Tennessee, had has a manufacturing plant in his district that have had two deaths, not recently. One of them was in 2014, the other one in 2021, but both widows contacted his office about making some pretty dramatic changes in the workers' compensation law. After several meetings, the business community and doctor and Senator Wally worked out an amendment that basically would change by just a little bit the payment of death benefits to a single beneficiary. And if the surviving spouse remarries, I think the biggest change in current law is that it wouldn't automatically terminate benefits if there's a remarriage of their surviving spouse. As in current law, there would be a payment of a lump sum of 25% of the average weekly wage for 100 weeks. So that's that would be a fairly significant change in the current law. But the other changes, like removing the exclusive remedy in gross negligence cases, that part of it did not make it to the original bill and certainly didn't make it to the final amended version. But there are other bills that scope of practice bills for PAs and NPs and physical therapy that are sort of moving at various stages through the legislative process. I won't go into those because they're complicated and they're being amended and lots of nuances there. We'll make one final point about medical cannabis and cannabis in general. It does not seem to be moving forward this year. Has been widely reported in the media. There's maybe six or eight of these pot bills that were filed, and some of them are still languishing. The main one that proceeded to a committee vote and failed was Senator Bowling's annual medical cannabis bill. It still does not have sufficient support to make it through the committee process. The Delta 8, Delta 10 regulatory bill, that's still moving forward. Looks like a lot of folks think that's got a chance to pass this year. It did not last year. And there is a bill that is moving forward that changes the makeup of the Medical Cannabis Commission by adding a patient who has suffered from one of the covered conditions to be added to the Cannabis Commission. So that one looks like it will pass, but the others, it doesn't look very good. The recreational, of course, does not seem to have anywhere near the votes to be able to move through the process. But it looks like medical cannabis, for the most part, is going to be next year at the earliest. If anybody's got any question about any of that, feel free to email me or ask, and I'll help however I can.
So, Drew, what's the driving factor behind, I assume the panel bill is to make us a non-panel state. Is there a reason behind that, or?
What I've heard is it's the general access to care concerns that we've had. I think for a change like that to happen, though, things are going to have to be, I mean, that's a pretty significant and drastic change from current law. And for something like that to happen, there's going to have to be a really serious problem in Tennessee that gets the attention of the business stakeholders and the insurance stakeholders. And I don't think we have gotten to that point yet. I'm not saying it might not get to that, but it has not risen to that level to get the attention of the business stakeholders and insurance stakeholders and the legislature yet.
Lisa Hartman has her hand up. Lisa?
Is there any way we could get like a synopsis of those bills, what their intent is, how it impacts us as a committee and the providers and the workman's comp people that are on workman's comp? The employees, I'm saying. And get that emailed out to us.
Well, I've got a list of the bills that I could send, and I have, at the end of the session, after the legislative session is done and, you know, bills are approved or not approved and signed by the governor, we prepare a year-end legislative update that we post on our website. But during the legislative session itself, as far as analyzing or putting our, you know, positions or anything like that out there, we're sort of prohibited from doing that since we are an executive branch entity, and we work through the governor's office, and those things are all sort of, you know, sort of in a confidential status until the process runs its course. But I can send you my list that has a caption of the bill out to the side of it, if that would help. And then there's a link to the General Assembly website that you could click on for more information if you'd like.
Okay, thank you. I would appreciate that.
Troy, with regards to mission physical therapy, I'm always going to perk up when you say that. So you kind of glossed over it. What's the bill that's pending in summary?
Let's see. There is maybe more than one. Let's see, Senate Bill 72 by Senator Watson will allow the practice of physical therapy to be done under the written or oral referral of a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. And it also does some stuff about the education requirements there as well. I think there was an amendment that was bouncing around. That bill has already passed in the Senate, but it has not yet made its way through the House. So what I'll do is I'll send this list, and if you click on the link, you can pull up a copy of that and either print it off or save it as a PDF. And, you know, that way you'll have the information directly.
Thank you. Dr. Kaiser? You're muted.
How about that?
Okay.
Great. Sorry. Correct me if this is not the appropriate time to ask this. But with regulations with the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, do those have to be done legislatively, or does this committee have anything to do with that, or does Dr. Snyder do that? How does that actually happen?
Well, if it's legislation that requires a statutory change, we're limited to making a presentation in May or June every year to the governor's legislative team for basically our wish list.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to submit that in writing and do a face-to-face presentation. And then we wait until the fall, and then they let us know what part or parts of that were approved to be included in the governor's package for the following January. But if you're talking about rules and regulations like the fee schedule rules or the utilization review rules, case management, those things are on a year-round basis. And the process is, you know, if you've got something like that, send it to me or to Dr. Snyder. We'll include it in our yearly review. And the process on that is we have a public rulemaking hearing. We file a notice, which is a preliminary copy or a draft of the proposed rules. We have to file that with the Secretary of State at least 50 days prior to the date of the rulemaking hearing. We have the rulemaking hearing. We keep the comment period open for 14 days. We decide then what changes we're going to make, and then we send the final version over to the Attorney General's office, and that's where it goes under a fairly lengthy review. Once we get that approved and back from the AG's office, then we file the final version with the Secretary of State and then appear before the Joint Government Operations Committee within a 30 or 60 day period. And the effective date's 90 days from the date we filed the final version with the Secretary of State. So that process is a fairly lengthy process as well, but it's more fluid. It's not on a rigid, say, June to January every year schedule like the legislation is.
Like two things I had in mind, maybe you can just kind of guide me on the appropriate way to do this, is number one, I think there should be some form of regulation or law or whatever it would be that would state that the workers' compensation carrier is required to give written notice to the treating physician that benefits have been terminated. I probably have a dozen times a year where I get a claim that's denied. It'll say, you know, benefits were, you know, this was settled a month ago. And even though we have a written contract that says that we expect written notification, and we usually prevail on that, you know, with the assistance of the Bureau, but it's just, it's a nuisance. And it seems to me, you know, they're well aware who their treating physicians are, and it's easy to communicate and give notification. And it seems like that should be a requirement. The other being the issue of the presumption that you're part of a PPO network. We're getting more and more. I just got this today, a request that we should send in our treatment contract that says that we're not on a PPO agreement every single bill we send in, just so they don't make the mistake of putting us in the PPO network. It seems to me the presumption should be that if I've not agreed to your discounted network, that I'm just a normal old doctor and I need to be paid according to the Tennessee fee schedule. And I'm not sure if either of those have any form of regulation now or the avenue, if it would be in the, if everyone would agree to that, you know, the avenue of proceeding with that. But that's kind of what I'm getting at. So those two things.
The first one is on our list, of possible amendments to our, insurance claims handling standards. All of our rules are under a mandatory review right now. There was a piece of legislation that passed a year or so ago that mandates departments go through a cycle of reviewing all of its rules every 8 years and repealing those that are not necessary anymore, and updating those that are necessary. Amanda's been working on that with all of our directors, and she's about halfway through that process. But as a part of the claims handling standards, that first one that you discussed about the, you know, subsequent closure of medical benefits and a work comp claim and notifying the treating physician, that's one of the ones that's on the list to review. Now, the second one that you mentioned about the presumption in the PPO network, I don't know. I don't know if we've had that one proposed to us yet or looked into that. And Dr. Snyder, have you reviewed that or heard anything about that?
No, I have not. But I will email Dr. Kaiser and get a little bit more specifics. That will fall under that statute. The silent PPO statute. So let us look at that. That's the first time I've heard that particular recommendation. And certainly it would be beneficial when it comes to the clarity of reimbursements.
I'll forward the email I got about that today to Susie, and you can, okay, if you want to send me something, we can talk later then. Thank you.
I do have one other question on that.
Yes.
Just from last month's minutes, I wasn't here last month, for the approval time went from 3 to 4 days for adjuster approval and utilization review. And it says that we're going to be monitored, or they are going to be monitored more closely. What does that mean?
What it means is that when we look at the utilization review appeal, we look at the dates that the physician ordered a treatment and look at the date that the utilization review was instituted. And so I have, was just part of my report that we have two instances that we sent to the penalty unit since January of failure of timely response from the adjuster to request the treatment.
Dr. Sutter, could you repeat that question? Dr. Cole said he couldn't hear it.
Okay. The question was that when, in last month's minutes, when we announced that the response from the adjuster to a request for treatment was extended from 3 days to 4 days, that we would monitor that more closely. And I just told Mr. Hedrick that we had sent two of those to penalty since the first of the year.
Some providers submit a problem to the Bureau. It's basically what happens.
They can do that. Actually, Dr. Bellner sent one of those.
Okay.
The other one, we picked up the other one on in our utilization review appeals. So we can receive it from either case from either the provider saying that they did not get a response or if we pick it up on the appeal.
I'd like to go back to Dr. Kaiser's first point with the notification when the claim has been terminated or denied. So the provider obviously should get notification of that in writing. Now, does that also include that any visits that occur between that denial date and the date of notification to the physician, that those should be paid and covered, or that the carrier should pay those up until the date that the physician is notified or the office is notified, as opposed to the date that it's denied? Because I see that in my practice, like a claim will be denied and I get the notification of that 3 or 4 weeks later, and there's been another one, maybe sometimes two visits in the interim that are covered. Or I also see very frequently when it's denied, they deny payment on everything, even the first visit that was either authorized by the employer or authorized by the entity that denies it. And there's one particular carrier that's notorious, I think, for that.
So there's, the first thing is the wording of the recommendation on the claims handling standards. We have to work that out. And how that notification occurs and the timing for that and what payments are due is going to be part of that, the language as to how that's phrased. Okay. The claims handling standards right now specify that the adjuster must notify the injured worker within 2 days of the change of an adjuster status. Okay. Right now, that's the only thing that has to do with claims, the adjuster notification in the claims handling standards. What we're going to do is add the fact that they have to notify the other parties to the claim, including the providers, when there's a change in the adjuster status, as well as when there's a change in the claim status, whether or not it's been denied, whether it's been closed, whether it's been closed for future medicals. And so Troy's taking notes on that as to how we phrase that, including in the claims handling standards.
Right. So obviously that's an access to care issue.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, denial of payments is certainly one of the things that irritates physicians more than anything else. Yeah.
Especially when you're ordered.
Okay. So we're going to have to be very careful about who gets notified. So it's going to have to be not only the authorized treating physician, but also providers within, I don't know, Troy, we're going to have to work out that providers of record.
Yes.
Providers of record.
We have patients that come in and say they haven't been notified that their claim has been closed.
Well, that claim closure and claim denial are something that they get. For claim closure, they have to agree to a settlement agreement with the court. So if they close a claim, whether it be for open medicals or for if they close the medicals, there's a settlement agreement that the injured worker has to agree to. So if they're not getting notified, it's because their attorney is not notifying. Okay. Now the other one is claims denial. That, as far as I know, the providers are not notified of that. Susie, you may correct me on that, but I don't think that the providers are notified on that.
Dr. Snyder?
Yes.
When we deny a claim for compensability, the providers are required to be notified by a C-23, just the same as the employee and the insured. All parties are to be notified of a denial of compensability.
Okay. Thank you for that correction.
Yeah, that's one of those few exceptions to the electronic filing. Like Misty pointed out, the physician and the injured worker and their counsel, if they have one, are supposed to get a paper copy of the notice of denial.
Send them to me, then. If you're getting late denial, send it to me. We can certainly look at that. So
Misty, what time frame is that notification carried out?
The notification is, we actually send those letters out usually the day of the denial, for sure within one business day of the denial. And our adjusters are instructed that we really need to provide the verbal notification of the denial as well as the paper to the employee or their attorney immediately, even before we pull that trigger and send the letters.
Okay. All right. Ready to move on to utilization review? Or
Dr. Bellner has a hand raised or did?
Yes.
I just wanted you to add a little bit to Dr. Kaiser's wish list there. When the adjuster changes, I know you've been talking about it, that the treating physician be notified. But what we need, we're not getting all the information. We need the phone, the fax, the email, the new claim numbers. If there's a new company, we need all that because it's been impossible. The biggest example is now with AIG switching over to Gallagher Bassett. All the claim numbers changed, all the adjusters changed, all their emails changed, their phones, fax. And we call the main number of Gallagher Bassett to try to get the person. And the contact information they give us is the main number for Gallagher Bassett. And so none of the emails work. And they can't find the patients because they use the claim number. We only have the old AIG claim numbers. So it's a massive amount of people that are now lost that we can't get in touch with the adjusters. And if they did send it to the patients, the patients have no idea that they've gotten any communication about that. And then the last thing that I want to add to that wish list, when the Medicare set aside is done, we never know that as well. And it used to work out okay because patients would come in and they'd say, I did the Medicare set aside and now my, you know, I don't have the workers' comp anymore. And we were getting paid still at the Tennessee fee rate, fee schedule rate. We're not getting paid anymore from some of the companies. We're getting the Medicare rate, and there's a little disclaimer on it said that you can bill for the remainder to the patient. So we bring this up to the patient. They said, that's not what I signed. That's not the deal. And we don't have any of that information at all to see what they've signed, because we never know when that happens. That all happens without us knowing. The patient just shows up and said, I've settled my claim, and I have this new card that's going to pay your bill, and it's now we're getting the Medicare fee schedule.
And I'll say that when we said we're in a different situation, but we hear that on a daily basis in our business office, where you can, that claim has been denied, you can bill the patient. And we can't do that.
Since we're on wish lists, I don't know how many of y'all work with networks, but I would like to see something in the state of Tennessee, and Dr. Schneider already knows what I'm going to say. He's going to roll his eyes. I'd like to see the networks have requirements to communicate the adjuster and case manager to all stakeholders. They don't do that for rehabilitation professionals, by and large. Some of them do, some of them do not. But it needs to be a requirement. They do not give us the information, nor do they share it when we call them. It's not on the referral forms. And then on top of that, we do not get physician orders from networks. Only half the time do we get physician orders from the networks. We get referrals that say right shoulder, and it actually is a left hand. Now, we call the doctors to get those things. They're there for a purpose. They have a purpose. It seems like they need to help out and fulfill their purpose just a little bit. So there stands wish list.
Yeah. And not to follow on. I see that in, when I refer to PT through a network. If I have specific goals or requests,
that's right.
Those seldom get passed on
to the therapist.
Right. And a lot of times I don't know where they're going until you call me.
That's exactly right.
And ask.
That's exactly right.
And you call, but a lot don't.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Dr. Cole. We all agree.
I think Lisa Hartman has her hand up.
Another hand, yeah.
I was concerned about the two or three of y'all have said that your patients aren't notified of the denials, and y'all aren't notified of the denials too. And Missy said that they send out the notifications to everybody. I guess it's just her company, maybe. I don't know what the other companies do. But would it be prudent to, I don't know if they're sent out by registered mail or not, or certified mail. Would that help to ensure that everybody gets notified of everything? If it's just sent out in regular mail, it may not ever get there, but the certified mail, it can be tracked. So can our committee decide that they need to do it that way or not?
Let us look at what the present statute said or the present regulations say, and we'll report back at the next committee meeting.
Okay, because I'll be glad to make that motion.
Let us look into that.
Okay. I was just thinking that may cure the problem for the providers and the employees that come in and don't know they've been denied.
If a provider is directly contracting with an insurance company, that would help. If we're contracted through a network, the network's dependent upon, they get it. The insurance company is dependent upon the network to communicate that information. So if there's not a layer of legislation that addresses the network, we'll only hit part of it. It'll probably be more the physicians than it will be the rehabilitation providers. 70% of our networks.
I can hear Dr. Snyder barely, but I couldn't hear you at all, sir.
Okay.
Speak up.
All right. So when we talk about the communication from the insurance companies to the providers, there's a difference between the rehabilitation providers and the medical providers. The networks are responsible for giving us information from the insurance companies, but they're not doing that in a timely fashion or at all. That's to the rehabilitation people. So if we address just the insurance companies with what we're talking about, we're not addressing the networks. And so that won't cover the rehabilitation professionals who are exposed to the same risk of not knowing if the case is closed.
Okay, thank you. I thought I had said to all the people involved, all the providers involved, that would include y'all, what I would propose.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought, and I would say that that's very true, that it's not a requirement on the state forms that the ancillary providers be notified, only the primary provider. We certainly try to do that pretty quickly ourselves, but I can understand and foresee that there are companies that may not be following that process.
Thank you all for that input. Does someone else have their hand up? Okay.
I think we were adjourned before.
Yeah.
No problem. Utilization
for calendar year 2022. The Bureau completed and resolved 1,099 utilization review appeals, which is down slightly. 2 years ago, it was 1,400 roughly, so it's down slightly. As far as the percentages are concerned, we uphold 50% of the utilization review appeals that are sent to us as denials. We overturned 31% of those, and 19% or so of the utilization review appeals are closed for administrative purposes. And those administrative purposes can be is that they are analysis of causation, which we cannot rule on, or the adjuster approves the treatment after being notified of the utilization review appeal. So our figures again, roughly 1,100 utilization review appeals resolved, of which we uphold of around 50% of those appeals. As far as the times are concerned, it takes us on average 21 days to get the complete records. And this has been a problem all along. We have are in the process of speeding that up a little bit by some of the penalties that we've issued. Once we receive all of the records, on average, it takes us less than 2 days to complete an appeal and send out the determination. So I'm very proud of our staff for doing that. And so we continue to work on the medical records issues. The next part of the utilization review report is the penalties. The medical unit, the utilization review appeals unit, has sent 10 requests for penalties to the penalty unit. One was notification that the reviewing physician had used the wrong diagnosis and the wrong guideline to issue a denial. Two of them, where we're from, where the physician for the denial had refused to respond to a request for information. That the physician, the authorized treating physician, had failed to respond to a request from the utilization review organization for further information. We sent two for, as we said before, for an untimely response from the adjusters for a request for treatment. We sent two for violations of peer-to-peer recommendations. Now, what I mean by that is that the physician requested a peer-to-peer contact, and the peer, the reviewing peer never responded. And then finally, we had three requests for medical records that the adjusters had not responded to. And so we sent those to penalties. So in the course of the last 2.5 months or a little over 2 months, we've sent 10 notifications to penalty that have been sent out to various offenders. Any questions on that? So if you feel that, as far as providers are concerned, that if there's a failure to respond, let me know. We do act on those. We do look into them. We pick some of them up by complaints from providers, and we pick some of them up by complaints from patients, and we also pick them up in our utilization review appeals.
Very good. Do we have a COVID update?
We do. The first part of the COVID update is that we have seen a very little change in the total numbers of applications. So since the start of January of 2020. We've had 14,000 first reports of injuries, and benefits were paid to 1,636 of those. 52 fatalities have been first report of injury or fatalities reported under the COVID codes, of which 15 of those have been accepted and payments have been made. At the present time in the courts, there are two pending cases. One had to do with a reaction to a COVID vaccine. And the second is a dispute over a death claim. So two cases before the courts, neither one had been settled. There were 12 other cases which made it through mediation and were accepted as a dispute that have been dismissed. Most of those were dismissed because the individual claimant did not properly complete what was necessary to continue the case. In other words, they didn't respond to court orders. They didn't respond to requests for information. Okay? And so there's been very few total court cases in the state of Tennessee concerning COVID claims. So right now there's only two pending, and so far no other decisions have been made by the courts on COVID claims.
Do we have any information on the severity of the reaction to the vaccine?
No, I do not. All I know is that they have, it's still pending before the court. That's as much as I know. We do have some figures from NCCI and from workers' compensation insurance rating that COVID claims during the first 6 months of medical treatment are around $6,800 on average, compared to all other claims being approximately $2,500 in medical payments. Hospitalization raises the cost of COVID claim. The average non-COVID claim medical benefits is $22,000, but for hospitalized patients with COVID, it's $77,000. So a significant difference between COVID and non-COVID claims. NCCI has reported $630 million in COVID incurred losses over 80,000 claims, with an average approximately $7,800 in total claims cost for a COVID claim, which is higher than the average cost for most claims, which is under $3,000. So just to let you know, when COVID claims are accepted, they cost more. Interestingly enough, we have not seen anything in the present time, nor the courts have seen, or the ombudsman or the mediation program has not seen any activity concerning long COVID claims, which I would expect to start to arise anytime soon, but so far we've not seen any. That doesn't mean we aren't going to see any, but it may be that long COVID will have a delayed ability to get approved as a compensation as a compensation claim. So that's our COVID update.
Any questions or comments? So any new business or announcements?
Well, I have some new business that is percolating. We're not ready for any actual further discussion, other than to notify the committee that the Bureau has been working since before the first of the year with the Department of Commerce and Insurance concerning issues with contracts and workers' compensation. Not only the applicability of contracts, but also issues that have to do with access to PPO networks through merged entities. There has been a lot of merger entities when it comes to bill review agencies and utilization review agencies. And so the Bureau has been working with the Department of Commerce and Insurance concerning these contracts. We have received a request to expand the definition of authorized treating physician for the for workers' compensation to include psychologists. This is something that would certainly require a statutory change and would require a lot of background information, but we have received that request. If in fact PTSD and these presumption bills go forward, it would require a significant investigation by the Bureau as to how to provide those services within workers' compensation. And finally, at our next meeting, as part of the regulation that went into effect for utilization review the rules for utilization review in September. We have required the utilization review organizations to issue us an annual report. To date, we have received approximately 15 of utilization review reports with significant numbers. And so we will have a report on those annual reports at the next meeting. It includes the total numbers of utilization reviews that were done in the state of Tennessee during the course of 2022. Also, the number broken down by denials, by modifications, and by approvals or authorizations or certifications, depending upon the word you use, and also the number and types of physicians that made those reviews, broken down by physician and by their activity concerning denials, utilization reviews, denials, modifications, or approvals. So I think we'll get some very interesting information about the utilization review activities in the state from that report. And that's all of the new business that I've had.
That will be interesting. Okay, so any announcements? All right. If not, we'll announce our next meeting for June 6, 2023. And if no other business, we will go ahead and adjourn.
Thank you, everybody, for attending. For the next meeting, it would help us if you want to come in person, it will give us a chance to set up the right number of chairs. And I appreciate everybody attending, and thank you so much.